This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this hour, we're reflecting on some of the through lines that animated our coverage this year and helped us make sense of where we are. One idea that seems to strobe through our stories, especially the deep dives, is that if you dig into our national narratives and those of much of the rest of the world, racial stereotypes, suspicion, and fear lay at the bottom.
After the March attacks on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, that killed 51 and injured dozens, we asked University of Chicago historian Kathleen Belew to lay out some of the ideological fundamentals of the white power movement, the notions that motivated that shooter, and also the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. Replace us. What does that even mean?
People in the white power movement see a whole number of social issues as fundamentally being about a threat to white reproduction. Abortion is a threat because it might kill white children. Immigration is a threat because of the threat of hyperfertile populations of color overrunning a white nation. LGBT rights and feminism are a threat because they might encourage white women not to bear white children. All of this is felt not as a soft demographic change, but as a real apocalyptic threat.
The attack on the synagogue in Pittsburgh, on the historic black church in Charleston, on the mosques in Christchurch might seem to be prompted by different flavors of hate, but actually, it's all the same hate.
All of those perpetrators are motivated and connected by the same ideology, the same kind of view of what their violence is supposed to do. Certainly things like the Oklahoma City bombing and Anders Breivik's attack in Norway would belong in that same story. Doing that would create a different kind of reporting that doesn't rely on the idea of lone wolves, but actually does the work of connecting these events together. It would allow a different kind of public conversation about what these events mean. And it would create a different kind of expectation about what kind of surveillance and legal resources need to be dedicated to this moving forward.
The replacement theory reminded me of what the president tweeted this summer.
Here's what the president tweeted yesterday.
So interesting to see progressive Democrat congresswomen who originally came from countries whose governments are a complete and total catastrophe, the worst, most corrupt and inept anywhere in the world, if they even have a functioning government at all, now loudly and viciously telling the people of the United States, the greatest and most powerful nation on earth, how our government is to be run. Why don't they go back and help fix the totally broken and crime-infested places from which they came, then come back and show us how it is done? These places need your help badly. You can't leave fast enough.
Then came the chants.
The following week, we called Ibram X. Kendi, founding director of American University's Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center and author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, who wrote about how those chants resonated in the African-American community.
When Black people are told, go back to Africa, most Black people will be like, exactly where would I go? I mean, I've traveled to West Africa, I've traveled to Ghana, and I don't feel as if I'm home. West Africans don't see me as one of them, just as Americans don't see me as one of them. And that's why I talked in that piece about this sort of envy. African Americans, on some level, have long been sort of searching for a nationality because we have not been made to feel as if we are American, and there's nowhere else in the world that, of course, we could consider home. And a certain segment of African Americans have said, we are American, and because we're an American, we deserve to be free. We deserve equal rights. While another segment of African Americans have said, we are not Americans, because if we were American, we would have freedom. We would have equal rights.
Where do you fall?
Both ring true to me.
It strikes me that the storm comes the same week as the Justice Department's announcement that it wouldn't be bringing federal civil rights charges against one of the officers involved in Eric Garner's death in New York City in Staten Island. Attorney General Barr made the decision the day before the fifth anniversary of his death.
I am very angry. I stand here in the spirit of my sister, who fought for justice until her dying day for my father. So no, there won't be no calm. No, there won't be no peace. No justice, no peace.
You've talked about how focusing on ignorance ignores the root of what racism really is about. Have we been focusing on the wrong news all week?
We should recognize and focus on the actual policies that are being justified by these ideas of go back to your country. Mass deportations of people. I'm talking about people who are being mass incarcerated, people who are being killed by the police, and that police officer never facing justice. I'm talking about people who are being disenfranchised and demoralized. These are many different forms of policies that are effectively removing people from the body politic of America. I see a very clear line between go back to your country and a police officer choking to death an unarmed black man. So that young man is essentially gone back into the soil. There's a very clear line I see. And so it's not surprising that the same Trump administration has decided to not pursue civil rights charges for Eric Garner's killer and is also telling four congresswomen of color to go back to their country.
In your article in The Atlantic, you talked a little bit about this sort of inner screaming that was going on. And I wondered if you could just describe how you felt as the week went on.
Well, as the week went on, which of course was a week that in many ways was representative of a lifetime, those constant shouts of go back to your country causes some people to ask the question, well, is this my country? And of course, people end up probably saying, yes, I'm an American. I'm just as American as anyone else. But other people never even have to question whether they're an American.
I'm sorry you have to keep explaining that.
It's okay. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wrote that piece, because I wanted to give people a window, you know, a way to get into people's minds, how they're taking in the last week, specifically looking at America's history. So we have to be willing to step into other people's shoes and to be empathetic. That's essential to being anti-racist.
In a country riven with white nationalism, there are so many others. Blacks, Latinos, Muslims, LGBT, women, all variously targeted as polluting American society. And then there is one of history's oldest and most enduring scapegoats, the Jews. In the United States, according to the Anti-Defamation League, reported anti-Semitic incidents increased by 150% between 2013 and 2018. On Twitter in 2017, the ADL counted a minimum 4.2 million English language anti-Semitic tweets. And the violence, most recently the murder of four in a New Jersey kosher butcher shop, has spiked as well. Leo Ferguson of Jews for Racial and Economic Justice has no illusions about reversing millennia-old hatreds and tropes, but he does see some hope in a latter-day rainbow coalition.
as a Jew and as someone who has spent some time studying anti-Semitism, one thing that I know is that Jews are less safe when people believe that they have no control over their economic destiny, that they are being crushed by wealthy, powerful people. Unfortunately, the analysis that the white nationalists and the folks on the right have is a sort of cheap one that says, blame the Jews, blame George Soros, blame the globalists. I have a very different understanding of what it is that is hurting working people. My people were brutally murdered because too many of their fellow countrymen believed that they were responsible for poverty and real economic hardship and pain. So it means a lot that, you know, since we last spoke, we saw Amazon get shoved out of New York by a coalition that included Jews and Muslims and Sikhs and all different kinds of folks saying, this is not our vision for the city that we want. This is not where we believe we are going to find prosperity. That's very powerful. Like, us building power together across lines of difference towards a much brighter future, that's what is going to keep us safe. That is the true antidote.
Well, it's an interesting thought that if nationalism and white separatism and general right-wing extremism grows out of a sense of economic and cultural insecurity, that if these very same communities can be empowered to see the results of their own actions, that will take the pressure off the Jews as the scapegoats for everything. But does that really deal with the underlying millennia-old forces of just plain animus?
That makes me think of Ta-Nehisi Coates, who points out that, you know, we don't have a roadmap for this. There is no manual for how to undo centuries and centuries of these ideas infecting our society and shaping the fortunes and histories of nations and people. So all we can do is look towards what looks good, what looks right. It looks better to me to have a future in which there is broad shared prosperity, in which all people, including Jews, feel safe. My sense is that's probably a step in the right direction. It doesn't mean that we don't also have to call out anti-Semitism, that we don't have to name it and identify it and pick it apart and understand it. I don't think we have to choose. In fact, frankly, I think we can't do one without the other.
Of course, it's hard to look past years of suspicion and embrace a shared destiny when the government, by executive order, defines your separate nature. In what he claims was an attempt to protect Jews from anti-Semitic harassment on campuses, Donald Trump earlier this month invoked a law that protects people from discrimination over nationality or race.
My executive order prohibits federal funding to any college or university that spreads, promotes, tolerates, or supports anything having to do with anti-Semitism.
But Judaism is neither a nation nor a race, so many American Jews reacted to the order with a thanks but no thanks. The last thing they want, they say, is to put an asterisk next to American.
So, who is an American? What is an American? This year, we really dug into the idea of national myth-making and the ways our national narrative paint its darkest chapters with a heroic gloss. Take the frontier thesis, drawn from late 19th century historian Frederick Jackson Turner, who argued that the frontier shaped the nation's unique character and democracy. In the end of the myth, from the frontier to the border wall in the mind of America, author Greg Grandin painted a detailed picture of the use of the frontier in the 19th century on at least two fronts. First, it would serve as a sort of safety valve to relieve the pressure on the class system exerted by an expanding and economically unequal population of immigrants and wage laborers.
And the second problem, the safety valve, was thought to solve was the question of slavery.
You quote the editor of the Western Monthly Review, Timothy Flint. He proposed America buy Mexican territory because it would serve as the proper escape valve from the danger of too great an accumulation of blacks in the slave states. thinning the population by diffusing it over great surfaces. And when it comes to class, you have the Massachusetts Congressman Caleb Cushing in 1839, who called the West the great safety valve of our population.
One of the dangers that somebody like Cushing identified was that as the vote was extended to unpropertied white men, to working class, illiterate white men, the fear was that they would use that vote to vote in socialism, to vote in a labor party. So what to do? Their answer was to use the expansion West, the distribution of public land in the West, as a way of diffusing and dispersing concentrated social demands.
It seems that Cushing was also a bit of a libertarian because he hoped that the westward movement would also keep the government occupied.
Well, exactly, because that's the second problem, right? That the problem of concentrated wealth and the problem of social movements contesting that concentrated wealth is that you wind up having the growth of government trying to solve the problem, either becoming overly repressive in clamping down on the demands or overly generous in distributing property. And either of those solutions were anathema to somebody like Cushing. So what's the solution? You go west.
Huh. But what happens when you run out of the American West? You move in all directions. You continue to claim land, to extract its resources, to exploit the locals. What's usually called building an empire. That's what America did, though you might not know it. And there's a good reason why you might not know it. The map of the U.S. you grew up with, you know, with the lower 48 spanning from coast to coast, jutting out in the southeast with a protrusion for Florida and a smaller one for Texas.
So that map, the contiguous blob with oceans on either side and Canada in the north and Mexico in the south, that's only been the borders of the United States for 3 years of its history.
So for me, one of the biggest revelations of the year came in the form of a book interview with Daniel Immerwahr, author of How to Hide an Empire, which counters both our visual image of the nation and the prevailing narrative of a republic. Seems we embarked on the project of empire practically from the moment we started running out of West.
It's an extraordinary moment. In 1898 and 1899, the United States basically goes on a sort of imperial shopping spree. It fights a war with Spain, and as a result of that war, it takes the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico, and it briefly occupies Cuba. And at the same time, almost in a fit of enthusiasm, the United States also annexes Hawaii and American Samoa. I found books that have titles like The Greater United States, The Imperial Republic, the old way of referring to the country as the United States, the Republic, or the Union in the 19th century. Those don't really work anymore because it's now transparently not a republic and not a union. This new polity, quite transparently, has not been created by the voluntary entry of all parts. The Philippines fights a bloody war of independence that we think racks up more bodies than the U.S. Civil War.
One of the most clarifying things that you do in your book is to describe the trilemma that placed the central ideas of what the United States is in conflict with each other when confronted with its imperialist role.
That's right. In the late 1890s, when many people in the United States are contemplating the future of the country, they realize that they can have an empire. They can have a country that's ruled by white people, and they can have a country that has representative government, but they can't get all three of them.
Why not?
Well, because think about it, because now the United States includes large non-white populations. So if the United States is going to continue to be Republican, Filipinos should have some kind of representative government and should have some kind of voice in the federal government of the United States. Those are the principles of republicanism. They're taxed, they should be represented. That seemed like it was a founding and core principle of the country. But there are a lot of anti-imperialists, including William Jennings Bryan, who worry about what happens to the United States if suddenly non-white people have political power. Some people try to solve this one way by allowing the expansion of the United States, but by rejecting its Republican principles. That's how Teddy Roosevelt thinks the United States should grow. It should have republicanism for the mainland, but not for the entire country. Others, like William Jennings Bryan, seek to resolve this by not having empire, by limiting the growth of the country so that it doesn't have the problem of large non-white populations who otherwise might need political representation.
And there's a really loud debate about this.
And it's in some ways a tragic debate because those are usually the two positions you hear. The United States should abandon republicanism or the United States should limit itself to its contiguous borders. What you don't hear in the mainland debate is the third option. The United States should jettison white supremacy.
They never considered taking white supremacy off the table. And yet they managed to reconcile these three incompatible ideas.
And largely this happens by not talking a lot about the territories. So if you can brush it under the rug, the United States can still present itself to itself and to others as a republic, a distinctive and exceptional world power without being an empire. And the argument is that people who live in the territories are just too different to be included in the calculation. So essentially, they are relegated to the shadows.
And so what happens to those shadow people, those who are denied full U.S. citizenship but are subject to its rule? Cornelius Rhodes, Harvard-trained doctor, arrives in Puerto Rico in the 30s, and he regards it as a sort of island-sized laboratory. Puerto Ricans are also enlisted as test subjects for chemical weapons technology the U.S. never used in World War II. The single bloodiest event to occur on U.S. soil happened during that war in the Philippines. 1.5 million dead. Did you know?
Mark Twain was referring to the Philippines when he wrote this. Quote, "There must be two Americas, one that sets the captive free and one that takes a once captive's new freedom away from him, picks a quarrel with him with nothing founded on, and then kills him to get his land." For that second America, he proposed adding a few words to the Declaration of Independence. Governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed white men. Brooke, in your series in June on eviction in America, it was chilling to hear how purposefully racial inequality was baked into the system. From the very moment that Lincoln's promise of 40 acres and a mule was revoked by Andrew Johnson. And then ever after, through redlining and zoning and denials of mortgages based solely on race, everywhere as African Americans headed north during the Great Migration.
When we first created this map, this is not what I thought it would look like.
Our partner in this series is Matthew Desmond, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, and founder of the Eviction Lab at Princeton. Matt pulls up on his cell phone a U.S. map charting our eviction hotspots.
This was kind of a shocker to me. These counties are shaded here, and the darker shading means higher proportion of African Americans in the county.
It's blue.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you just follow the blue, when you go through Alabama and Georgia and up to South Carolina and North Carolina, you see incredibly stunningly high eviction rates through Virginia. These are pretty low-cost areas that have these exploding eviction rates. And then you go up the Mississippi, and you can keep going into Detroit as if the eviction problem follows like the trail of the Great Migration. Black families searched for economic security and ran away from racial terrorism to go into North cities to be corralled into ghettos where they didn't own the land again. And so it's an old story, but it's kind of like our story.
The people who live here bought their homes from real estate speculators at double or triple their value. And they bought on contract because they couldn't get conventional or FHA mortgages. Under the contract, the buyer makes installment payments at high interest, but he builds no equity. If he defaults on even one payment at any time during the contract, he loses the property and everything he's paid into it.
Hank Roberts, a substantial man in his 60s, was 15 when his family was evicted. Hank takes me to the scene of his worst memory. His parents had bought a newly constructed home on contract in 1968. The street is quiet and plain.
You could imagine I was just like, seventh heaven. We're moving into a 5-bedroom, 2-full kitchen house. All my family was going to be there.
The Roberts family settled in, unaware that despite making their monthly payments, they'd never hold title on the house and that the contract was a scam. Once they understood, they joined the Chicago Contract Buyers League.
Why haven't you been sending your payments in, sir?
Because I feel that the contracts that we have are illegal.
I see there are so many people around. Could you tell me a little bit about it? Why are they here, sir?
We're together.
400 contracts were renegotiated between the tenants and the owners, but not all of them, not Hank's family's. It happened on a March morning in 1970.
It had to have been a weekend day. And we were all at home and we were having breakfast. And it was all over the radio.
Four more members of the Contract Buyers League were evicted this afternoon on the south side in the 8000 block on South State. At the scene, Task Force Commander William Mooney says some arrests have been made in connection with the evictions. This is John Adams, WGN News on the south side.
And I can recall sitting at a kitchen table and hearing like a baton or something bang on the door, like boom, 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 boom.
In Hank's neighborhood, police were conducting mass evictions block after block. From his front door, he could see his older sister's house, her stuff being hauled out and dumped.
There was just no sympathy from anyone to our plight, from the guys that threw the things in the street to the people that were coming by trying to take stuff. Too, I just have to say this, the way that I saw it then, I mean, I still sit here and go, God, did you have to do it that way? It was a torrential rainstorm. It's like everyone just pounded on us. And all that we were sitting there doing is saying, this is wrong.
Coming up, the hazards of trying to cram current events into a historical frame, and how the last decade has transformed how we make this show.
This is On the Media.